friends. Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. So, in honor of spooky season, and hopefully you guys like these types of episodes, yes, I'm doing a little haunted history of Colorado. Sorry, I just can't get enough. I find the Wild West so interesting and so very haunted. So today, we're going to be taking a trip to Trinidad, Colorado. So grab some popcorn and dim the lights and make sure to look over your shoulder because you never know what lies in the shadows at night. You ever walk into a place that feels alive, but not in a good way? Not with laughter, not with life, but with memory. Something heavier. Something watching. Because in Trinidad, Colorado, the past doesn't stay buried. It lingers. It breathes. It waits. A town born in violence, built on the backs of miners, bootleggers, outlaws, and the ghosts of the Ute people who were here long before any European ever laid a stake in this dusty red ground. In a place like this, where every brick tells a story and every gust of wind through the canyons carries a whisper, it's no wonder people say Trinidad is haunted. I'm Rachel O'Brien, and this is Seven Deadly Sinners. Tonight, we are heading to Trinidad, Colorado, a town with a bloody frontier birth, mafia entanglements, coal mine disasters, and hauntings that refuse to rest. From the Bloom Mansion, where wealth met tragedy, to the Terrabino Inn, where guests wake up to whispers of the dead, Trinidad might just be one of the most haunted towns in the American West. Trinidad, Colorado sits just 11 miles north of the New Mexico border, a stone's throw from Raton Pass, where the mountains tighten around the Santa Fe Trail like a noose. And that drive is terrifying, I could tell you that much. It was and still is a crossroads between north and south, between civilization and wilderness, and between life and whatever comes after. Before the town's founding in 1862, this land belonged to the Ute tribe, proud and resilient people who had lived in the high plains and mountains of southern Colorado for centuries. But by the 1840s and 50s, the encroachment was relentless. Settlers pushing west, soldiers building forts, prospectors hunting for gold. And with each new wagon wheel that rolled across Ute land, tension grew. In 1849, the Ute people signed treaties that were supposed to preserve their land, but as usual in American expansion, those treaties were broken almost before the ink was dry. Soon, the Ute were being pushed out of the very valleys they'd called home. Their hunting grounds turned into ranches, their sacred hills blasted for coal, and by the 1870s, after the Meeker Massacre and the Ute War, the tribe was forced onto reservations in western Colorado and Utah. But you know what they say about sacred land? It never forgets. Old-timers in Trinidad will tell you the spirits of the Ute still move through the wind that howls off Simpson's Rest, a cliff that looms over the town. They say if you stand there at sunset, you can hear chanting in the canyon, drums that aren't there, footsteps that stop right behind you, even when you're alone. One local legend claims that a Ute elder cursed the valley as his people were driven out, saying, "Your houses will fall, your blood will feed the earth, and your children will not sleep in peace." And when you hear what happened in Trinidad over the next 100 years, you might just start to believe him. By the 1880s, Trinidad was booming, rough, loud, fast-growing town built on coal and sin. Coal was king here. The mines carved deep into the hillsides, and immigrant labor poured in from everywhere. Italians, Irish, Croatians, Mexicans, men chasing the American dream in the choking dust of the mines. But the mines didn't just bring money. They brought violence. In 1888, Trinidad earned a new nickname, the wickedest town in Colorado. Saloon doors swung day and night. The red light district, known as the Line, stretched for blocks, lined with gambling dens, dance halls, and brothels. Gunfights were as common as weddings, and one of the most famous shootouts happened right on Main Street. It was 1882. Two men, both drifters, with short tempers and long memories, squared off outside a saloon called The Exchange. One was named William Dutch Thomas, and the other, Jack Hughes. They'd been drinking, gambling, and arguing over women, of course. When Hughes called Thomas a cheat, Thomas went for his gun, but Hughes was faster. Thomas dropped dead in the dirt right in front of the crowd of Saturday shoppers. But the chaos didn't end there. The sheriff arrested Hughes, but by nightfall, the saloon crowd had turned into a mob. They stormed the jail and dragged Hughes into the street, and before dawn, he was hanging from a telegraph pole. Terrifying. But stories like that become the rhythm of Trinidad life. Law came slow and death came fast. Even the women weren't spared. To this day, guests at the old buildings along Main Street say they see a woman in a crimson dress appear in mirrors just for a moment before vanishing into the wallpaper. But for all its blood and grit, Trinidad wasn't done collecting stories, because as the 20th century rolled in, a new kind of power was moving in. One that traded six shooters for suits and bullets for bribes. By the early 1900s, Trinidad had traded its cowboy chaos for something slicker, but no less dangerous. Gone were the tumbleweeds and revolvers, replaced with cigars, suits, and whispers. This was the new Trinidad, and the power here didn't wear a sheriff's badge anymore. It wore silk ties. You see, Trinidad's location made it a perfect hub for smuggling. Just 11 miles from the New Mexico border, with railroad lines crisscrossing out to Denver, Santa Fe, and beyond. It was a natural pit stop for bootleggers moving liquor during Prohibition. But not all the whiskey came in barrels. Some came in coffins, some in coal cars, and sometimes in the bodies of miners who'd outlived their usefulness. Now, Trinidad's Italian population had grown fast during the coal boom, many of them from southern Italy, men looking for honest work. But where there's labor, there's exploitation. And where there's exploitation, there's opportunity for crime. Rumors began to swirl of a small but organized group of men, Italian-born, tight-lipped, and loyal, running operations from back rooms of saloons and butcher shops. Locals called them the Montanatis. And even today, in old newspaper clippings and hushed stories from descendants of miners, you'll hear that name whispered with a shiver. They say the Montanatis were involved in everything: bootlegging, gambling, racketeering, even murder for hire. Now, I hope I'm saying that name right. Also, that's just something I've been told. If I do Google it, it doesn't really come up. Could be a misspelling of another name. But regardless, huge mafia presence. And one day, Greg and I are going to do a full podcast on the Black Hand Syndicate. So that's an FBI document I found that's like 75 pages long from 1919. It involves, all the murders. Anywho's will be. So it's said that their headquarters was a beautiful red brick Victorian home that stands on the corner of Maple and 2nd Street now, the Terrabino Inn. So when I was researching this, I walked in there. I didn't want to be totally creepy because the head clerk wasn't there. I didn't want to trespass. Not that I haven't done that before on the podcast, but I was able to enter, but I didn't want to walk around because I don't know. Again, trespassing. But it was beautiful. I mean, opulent, gorgeous. It's just a huge old Victorian home. You know, with those ones where like they actually made things with strong wood and there's, you know, like a parlor on one side and then a formal dining room. I mean, it was really pretty, but maybe one day I'll stay there and see if I experience any of the spookiness. So but a guest there can expect beautiful stained glass windows, carved banisters, and the kind of creaky wooden floors that make every step sound like a sigh. But not all of those sighs come from the living. Guests have reported lights turning on by themselves, cold spots that follow you down the hall, and doors that open and close even when locked. One couple claimed they were woken in the middle of the night by the sound of a man's voice, low, angry, muttering in Italian, right beside their bed. But when they turned on the lamp, their room was empty. Another guest, a woman traveling alone, said she woke to the sound of heavy boots pacing her room. When she sat up, the boots stopped. She looked toward the doorway and saw a shadow just standing there. And when she screamed, it vanished, and the door, which had been locked, swung open on its own. The owners say the spirits are friendly, maybe even protective, but others aren't so sure. Because during the Prohibition years, the Terrabino home wasn't just a residence, it was a front. A place where the Montanani family allegedly held meetings, stashed contraband, and according to rumor, disposed of those who crossed them. Some say there are bodies buried beneath the basement floorboards. Others say the ghosts that wander those halls are not the victims, but the guilty. One of Trinidad's oldest residents, a man named Anthony DeLuca, once told the local paper that his grandfather wasn't afraid of ghosts, just living men who made them. He said that in the 1920s, his grandfather worked as a bartender at a place called the Silver Dollar Saloon. One night, two cars pulled up. Men in suits got out, dragging another man between them. They took him through the back door. No one ever saw that man again. But the next morning, the bartender found a pool of blood behind the building, and the silver dollar he'd been polishing the night before now bent in half. Trinidad became a town of whispers. Everyone knew someone who'd vanished. Everyone had a cousin or an uncle or a neighbor who'd just gone to Denver and never came back. But no one talked because everyone knew silence was the safest choice and that silence would last for generations. And still, Trinidad's ghosts don't rest. You can feel it when the sun goes down. The quiet unease that settles over the town when the streetlights buzz and flicker and the shadows stretch just a little too far. Because the men who built this place didn't just leave behind history. They left behind unfinished business. It's gonna get you. It's gonna get you. It's gonna get you. And nowhere is that more visible or audible than at the home of one of Trinidad's founding families, the Bloom Mansion. If the Terrabino Inn is Trinidad's haunted heart, then the Bloom Mansion is its ghostly crown jewel. Built in 1882 by Frank G. Bloom, a wealthy cattle baron and banker, the mansion was a testament to Victorian opulence. Tall arched windows, carved woodwork, chandeliers imported from Europe. Now, I also went there the other day, actually to visit my friend Austin, who works in the Bloom Mansion as a historical researcher. And that place is absolutely gorgeous. But Austin was telling me that, yes, it certainly is haunted. He will hear, no one will be in it. It's so you can tour it. It's a museum now. No one will be in there. And he'll hear footsteps up above it. And there's not even anything. We went all the way to the top floor. The top floor, they haven't redone those rooms yet. And he'll be down in his like office area working, and he will hear someone walking upstairs. So I've personally heard these stories. But back to Frank Bloom. He wasn't just rich, he was respected. But as we've seen time and time again in these stories, the higher they climb, the darker they fall. Frank and his wife, Sarah, lived a life of luxury. Lavish dinners, private carriages, servants in crisp uniforms. But beneath that polished exterior, there was sorrow. They buried two of their children before they reached adulthood. And as Sarah grew older, locals said she rarely left the house. Servants whispered that she'd wandered the halls at night, weeping softly, her white gown glowing in the lamplight. Even today, visitors and staff at the Bloom Mansion, now a museum, like I said, report strange happenings. Doors open on their own. Portrait eyes seem to follow you. Perfume fills empty rooms. One recurring sight, a woman in a long white dress standing at the top of the staircase. Always the same place. Always silent. Some people have tried to play it off as imagination, the power of suggestion. But one winter afternoon, a museum employee named Carla stayed late to close up. She was alone, or thought she was. As she turned off the last light in the parlor, she saw a reflection in the glass door, a woman standing right behind her. When Carla turned around, no one was there. But the faint smell of lilacs lingered for hours after she left. The mansion's basement holds an even darker rumor that during the coal wars, Bloom's business interests intersected with the mining companies who crushed union uprisings with brutal violence. Dozens of miners were killed in those conflicts, and some say their restless spirits found their way back to the mansion, a symbol of wealth built on their suffering. It's said that on stormy nights when lightning strikes the hills, you can hear the faint sound of pickaxes coming from beneath the Bloom Mansion. Ghosts digging, forever working, forever trapped. So between the curses of the displaced Ute, the miners buried in the hills, and the mobsters who ruled from behind lace curtains, Trinidad had earned its ghosts. But there's one more layer to this story. Main Street, Trinidad. It's peaceful now, lined with antique shops, little cafes, and murals that try their best to tell the story of this town's past without scaring all the tourists away. But if you stand in the right spot, near the intersection of Main and Commercial, and close your eyes, you can almost hear it. The year was 1905. The Wild West was supposed to be over, but in Trinidad, the gunfights never quite stopped. They just put on better clothes. Inside the Delmonico Saloon, a confrontation was brewing between two men, Sheriff Charles Wooten and a rancher named Tony Lovato. Wooten was respected, a lawman through and through. Lovato was reckless, hot-headed, had a knack for trouble, and that night, Trouble walked through the door, wearing spurs and a bad temper. The argument started over a gambling debt, like so many did in Trinidad. But within minutes, it turned deadly. Lovato drew first, but missed. Wooten returned fire, hitting Lovato in the chest. Lovato fell, clutching his heart, but somehow still managed to squeeze off one last shot. The bullet hit Wooten square in the throat. Both men died in seconds. And right there, in the middle of Main Street, Trinidad's blood-soaked legacy continued. They say the two men are still seen arguing in the street after dark, their outlines faint and flickering under the street lamps. And if you listen close on a still night, You can hear their boots scuffing against the stones, a gun cocking that never fires, a loop forever unfinished. So next time you find yourself driving down I-25, passing that sign that says, "Welcome to Trinidad," take a detour. Drive into town. Walk its old streets after sunset. You'll feel it. The pulse beneath your feet. The breath of history on your neck. Because this place, this beautiful, tragic, haunted town, is proof that ghost towns don't die. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And I just love you and I appreciate you. Happy Halloween.